Jai Ma. Thank you, Devendra Bhai. And let me start with a brief sentence, something that Sri Aurobindo wrote about various religions vis-a-vis Hinduism. So here he says, Hindu religion appears to me as a cathedral temple, half in ruins, noble in the mass, often fantastic in detail, but always fantastic with a significance, crumbled and overgrown in many places. But a cathedral temple in which service is still done to the unseen, and its real presence can be felt by those who enter with the right spirit. The outer social structure which is built for its approach is another matter. So Sri Aurobindo is distinguishing between two things here. One is Sanatana Dharma, what it stands for, what it means, what it can offer to the world. And the second is, as invariably happens, social structures, institutions, systems, philosophies, which develop around that nucleus. So actually when we approach Sanatana Dharma, one of the things that we encounter is, we feel we are entering one of those, very rich in detail South Indian temples, which right from the door itself, or even from a little distance away, it's appalling. It's, to use a modern language, awesome. And we tend to get lost in the details and we don't understand what is what. For example, one of the things that when you enter one of the temples, you see those Rakshasa kind Akriti in the door. So people often ask, why is this there? And I tell them, because there is a place for everything and everyone in Hindu thought. So it's a very vast structure, superstructure. And to understand anything, actually, we need to go first to the core. It's like when we look at a human being, we often try to judge him based on his outer manners, behaviors, dress, the way he speaks, the languages he knows, the money he earns. But that's not what the man is. You try to see what is his core, what is his aspiration, what is he really seeking in life. And you'll know everything that you need to know, because it's from there that everything else derives. The second thing which is important is that the need of rise of Sanatana Dharma is something which Sri Aurobindo has foreseen. And not only foreseen, he has said it's not just about India and the Hindu culture. For him, Sanatana Dharma is the one hope for the world. So if Sanatana Dharma, in fact he goes on to say that if Sanatana Dharma could perish, if at all there was such a thing like that, that means the world perishes. So it, because if we look at all the various ideas, ideologies and religions all around us, so we'll see that if at all there is any religion, I'm using the word religion right now in a very loose sense, which I'll come to a little later, then we see it is Sanatana Dharma which can really integrate all the diverse strands of human nature, which means not just the different religions, but also ways of life, different cultures, different unity in diversity, different aspirations of mankind. It can integrate science, it can integrate biology, it can integrate evolution, it can integrate psychology, and all the different approaches to God. So that's why, being very vast, it's a universal religion, and we need to it's needed for the world. And who are the carriers of this Sanatana Dharma? And that's where our role comes, whether we are in India, whether we are living anywhere in any part of the world, we are the carriers. So often people ask me, many of the Indians who live abroad, so it's a great and difficult task, because each one who is living abroad is in a way he is a carrier of this light. And how can you carry a light if we ourselves are unaware of what it really means and what its power is and how it can beautify the whole world, electrify the world and beautify it. So with this little background, let's come to some of the core things. Let's start with the two words, Sanatan and Dharma. Sanatan means eternal. What it means is that this religion, Dharma, I am using the words interchangeably for the moment, has no origin in terms of time, meaning thereby it's dateless. So that's something fantastic. It means that you can't pinpoint that this is a point of time when this started. And why this is important? Because then it takes into account all that has happened since the beginning of creation. You read any Hindu textbook, you'll find it starting from the origin. So this is so important, because otherwise when you have a dated religion which starts, let's say, in so many BC or AD or whatever it is, then whatever has happened before it, it tries to almost brush it aside. And we know it has created so many confusions historically. For instance, in Christianity we have, you know, the earth started 4000 BC. Because, you know, you can't understand what happened way, way before. There are a lot happening. So in Hinduism, there is no date fixed to this, because it starts from the eternal. And because it is eternal, it's not subject to perish, because it leans on certain fundamental truths which are embedded in existence regardless of any founder, regardless of a book, whether you read a book or not, whether you have a particular person or not. Still, these are fundamental truths of existence. Like, atom is an atom, is an atom. You can't help it. So it's the dharma of the atom to operate in a certain way. So it doesn't matter whether you have read a book about it or not, whether somebody has talked to you about it or not. So eternal word implies this. It also implies that it is universally applicable. You don't have to subscribe to it. You don't have to be a Hindu for the truths of Sanatana Dharma to act upon you. So this is the first part, eternal. Then there is the word dharma. So dharma implies it's not religion, it's not rule book, it's not a book where you put things in black and white and morally right and wrong, etc. Dharma is that this truth behind is unfolding. So dharma is about action, it's about unfolding. So there is an eternal truth, and based on that, when it enters into creation, it is what has entered into creation, or rather all creation, it's constant manifestation. And in the process of manifestation, many laws, many ways of being has come into existence. And dharma refers to that. So dharma is not a simple rule book of do's and don'ts. It's very vast and complex. To say the least, there is a dharma of the tiger to kill and devour the prey. But if human being uses the same dharma, that I can kill and devour and prey, and see how it makes a difference. For instance, many people say that survival of the fittest, that's what Darwin observed. And therefore, human beings are another animal kind. And therefore, they can, for the sake of survival, they can kill because survival of the fittest. But if you go to Sanatana Dharma, he'll say, no, sir, because the dharma of humans is different from the dharma of the tiger. The dharma of the tiger is different from the dharma of the fish. And dharma of the fish is different from the dharma of a plant, and so on and so forth. So dharma is whatever helps you to evolve. There is inbuilt a law of life. And that helps us to grow and evolve. If we don't follow according to that, then there is a problem. So the problem is that there is a current which is leading us in a certain direction. And it's good to know that this is where the current is leading you. So that's what dharma is about. Dharma is a law based on truth. It is not based on a person. It's not based on hearsay. It's not based on a book. So this is one brief, very quick background. Then, to understand Hinduism or Sanatana Dharma, there are few basic things or few words that we need to be conversant about. So one of the word is karma. We speak about dharma and we speak about karma. So beautiful thing about Hindu thought is that it's not about whether you believe or not. It's your actions, which is something which as modern generation we understand it. And we see that, you know, Ravan is a Brahmin. I'm just giving one example. Ravan is a Brahmin. Ravan is learned in the Vedas. But the karma of Ravan is, he's a lusty man, ambitious man, over-ambitious man, who simply crushes all kinds of opposition. Therefore, Ravan cannot escape his karma, even though he's a Shiva Bhakt. Look at the beauty of this thought, that both are Hindus, if you put it in traditional slot. Ravan is a Hindu. And Rama is a Hindu. And there are others who are not even Hindus. There are Vanaras who are forest dwellers. Vanvasis, as they are called. And yet, it is your karma which decides which way you will evolve and which way you will not evolve. So karma theory, very brief, because each of this is a vast subject, is something very beautiful because it's not a belief system. You may believe in any god or you may not believe in any god. You may be an atheist, you may be an agnostic, you may be a worshipper, but the law of karma is there. What the law of karma is, very simple. It's not about reward and punishment as we find in other religions. But it's a law of evolution. Meaning thereby, if people have seen the snake and ladders game. So there, this origin of this snake and ladder game is way back. Saint Ganeshwar, he's the one who had made it and devised it. And he had called it Mokshpat. So there are certain actions which help you move up the evolutionary ladder. Meaning thereby, evolution doesn't end with men, human beings, and even within the human body, a lot of evolution is taking place. So scientific, when we look at the biological aspect of evolution, 9 layers of humanity, which has been washed away before this humanity has come. And this too is growing. Meaning thereby, evolution is not finished. And based on how a human being acts, he may either go up the ladder or he may go down the ladder. And if he goes down the ladder, there is retrogression. He moves more and more toward the animal kind, the rakshasic kind, the asuric kind. So what happens if you move toward that? People say, so what's the great deal? The great deal is that the more you slide down the ladder, it's like slipping into a hole. So there is no light, there is no delight. But you need light and delight. So what do? You run out, you externalize to get something which can give you some joy of life. So now we understand the party culture. So the less joy, natural joy you have within, the more one will try to seek it outside. That means a civilization will be built which is hedonistic in nature, which is seeking only for pleasure. So people may say, what's wrong with it? Well, that means everything is a bhogya vastu. Meaning thereby, a woman is an object of pleasure. That means pornography industry. That means wine and dine and party culture, because that's what you are seeking. Why you are seeking? Not because of good and bad, simply because you have followed a way of life where you have entered into a hole. The more self-centered we become, the narrower we become, and this is a punishment if you want to call it. So you don't have to imagine a hell or heaven or last judgment day. Judgment is right away. The more selfish, self-centered we are, the more we are stung by jealousies, fears, anger, and the more we are stung by these enemies of the soul, as they are called, Shadripu, the more we feel unhappy inside, the more unhappy we feel, we need joy, so we try to devour, we try to plunder, we try to loot. So this is the logic of karma, how it operates. So it's not a mechanism of reward and punishment, but evolution. So we learn the consequences, we act, we learn through consequences, and we grow. So this is about karma. The third aspect is, well, any religion should tell us about 3 things. One is, who am I? What's myself? Second, who is God or origin? Let's not use the word God because it's already been corrupted. Is there a God at all? And the third, it should tell us what is this world and the relationship between these. This is what every religion should tell us. So let's start with ourselves. So what does Hindu thought tell us about who am I? So it doesn't deny, there is beautiful stories, paucity of time, so I'm not going into one of those stories of Upanishads where the son, who is also a disciple, he asks his father. He says, Father, I want to know the ultimate truth. And he says, okay, you meditate and come back. So he says, Annam Brahmeti. He says, matter is Brahman. And there are other stories also, Virochana in Indra. So he says, body is the ultimate reality. Father doesn't say no. He says, okay, but there is something greater. So he goes. Then he comes back. He says, Pranam Brahmeti. He says, the desired cell, the prana, the life energy, that is the ultimate reality. He says, all right, I'm not cancelling it. There's no cancel culture in Hinduism. So, but you meditate and come back further. So he comes back and says, well, it's thought that has gone into this world. He says, fine, but there's something still deeper. And he goes and ultimately he says that, well, Anandam Brahmeti. This world is an expression of delight. Can there be ever anything more positive and world-affirming and self-affirming? So we are seekers of delight. But so many of the proscriptions in Hindu thought, for instance, seeking after pleasure. It's not like a taboo, but you should understand, if you seek the lesser, then you devoid yourself of the higher. So there is something very beautiful in one of the Isha Upanishad, tena taktena bhunjita maghridaya kasya svidhinam. It says, by renouncing thou shalt enjoy. So we see there is so much importance to tyag, but tyag not for the sake of tyag, to call yourself a tyagi, or because when we renounce the lower, then we become adhikari of the higher. And that operates in life everywhere. And nowadays we use these words like emotional intelligence and all that, delay the gratification. But essentially the principle is this, that this world is arranged hierarchically. Everything is arranged hierarchically. So in Indian thought it's called as the systems of worlds or lokas or several bhuvan. And if you have to put it in terms of physics, we would say multidimensional universe. But what does it mean? It means, I'm tempted to quote Sri Aurobindo's Savitri, all our earth starts from mud and ends in the sky, and love that was once an animal's want, then a sweet madness in the heart, then a comradeship in the ardent mind, ardent comradeship in the mind, and then it goes, a lonely soul seeks the alone. So you see, there is a hierarchy. There is a purely animal kind of love. Call it love, but when you look at it from the higher, you'll call it lust. But there is a higher form of love, a more human love, where there is care, sympathy, mutual exchange. The animal part is there, but see how it is sublimated and it becomes something more beautiful, meaningful. Beyond it, there are higher, still higher forms of love. God-like love, spiritual love, union of the self with self at the ultimate level. So it looked at this universe as a evolutionary ladder. This is something very beautiful about Sanatana Dharma, and I love this absolutely, that we are constantly progressing from the lesser to the greater. It's like we are in a school and we are graduating from standard 1 to 2 and 3 and 4. So why this is interesting? Because it makes me feel I am young forever, because there is something to do. Not like I have finished. Now I have, you know, been, I have got a surname and I have got a religion stamped with me, and therefore it's end. No, this is not the end. I am in the school. It's a beginning. So in India, the concept of, for instance, baptization exists in a different way. So it's called Dvij. So it takes that there are two basic levels of the human journey. One is when it is journeying in ignorance. Then it doesn't matter what name you have, what religion you subscribe to, what is your surname. Doesn't matter at all, because you are bound within a realm of ignorance. Meaning thereby you don't know who you really are. You are, all these are ideas in the head, that you are a soul or you have no soul. Like belief and non-beliefs are all at the same level. So you may subscribe to this school of thought or that school of thought. It's okay. It's comfort zones. We can build our own comfort zone. But we are still in ignorance. Then a time comes when we want to really know, seek. Then a person who wants to seek, either he finds a book or a master, or after a preparation finds a path or stumbles upon it, any which way. So then he is called as a dvij, twice born. So twice born is equivalent to baptism or sunnat in the other two religions, but it's your journey doesn't end there, that okay, somebody has done it to you. No, you may be born in a Hindu so-called faith family, but your real journey, the second born, begins when within you there is an aspiration, an awakening to a greater life, a greater possibility. And this new journey has several steps to itself. And one of the major steps is moksha. Moksha is not coming back to, you know, the cycle of birth. That's up to each one. But moksha means freedom from ignorance. Mean thereby, now I know who I am. So who I am, what does Hindu thought say? It says you are a soul on a great journey. What is the soul on a journey of this cycle? You are on a journey of blossoming. So soul is seen like a seed. See, there is the idea of double evolution in a Hindu thought. So we are each a soul which is a seed of the divine. So what is this seed going to become? It is going to become the divine. Why? Because whatever is in the seed is going to blossom. So the purpose of life, if you ask somebody who really understands Sanatana Dharma, so he will say, well, ultimately to become one with God, to realize God, in different ways people, or to have vision of God, to find a guru, doesn't matter. But basically you are looking for becoming one with God. It's the highest goal. This is something not even dreamed of. And it's contained in two beautiful formulas. And the beautiful formulas are Sohamasmi. Sa Purusha Evasya. That Purusha there, that divine being. I too am that. But it doesn't end only by saying Sohamasmi. I am that. Aham Brahmasmi. I am that Brahman. It also says Tattvamasi. It's not like I am only God. Everyone is God. Everyone has the potential to be a God. Not, you know, a seed is of divinity. It doesn't matter. Even the most wicked person, evil person, has the seed of divinity. The mask is different. Sometimes you have to tear the mask. Sometimes the mask may entangle that seed and stifle it. So the rock is broken. Outer means are there because the seed will not blossom. So that's another story. But everybody has the seed of divinity, and that's why in Indian Sanatana Dharma you have yoga. Yoga is of course not doing Sarvasana and Sarvangasana, though I have a little dig at it that yes, yoga is doing Sirsasana because all the values of the world change. They turn upside down. What we valued before taking up yoga change. We valued too much, that seems to be a little place in the corner. And what we didn't value, we begin to value. So yoga is union. So man can unite with God. Why? Because man carries within himself the divine, the source. Now look at it, how logical it is. Because this was one of my questions during my medical days. That if there is a source, that time you know, question 17, 18. If. So if there is a God, he must be in everything. Logical. Because it's a source. You may call him God, reality, truth, whatever. That source has to flow in everything in some way or the other. Maybe as a particle, maybe as an energy, whatever it is. So if it is within us, it should be accessible in some way. And that's exactly what Hindu thought says. That while that divine presence in everything, the exceptional privilege of man is that it has reached a stage of evolution wherein human beings, after a certain stage of development, can access and find it. Potentially anyone can. But usually after a certain stage of development, one finds it. Therefore, in Hindu thought, there is no conversion. Why there is no conversion? The true conversion is when you suddenly feel the need, the urge to discover. And it's a conversion from the human to the divine. It's not a conversion from one religion to another religion, which is, religions are all basically at one level all the same. You have to leave one set of beliefs and accept another. So, but here the conversion means that the human consciousness is getting converted into the divine consciousness. So, myself is the same as the divine, but potentially. And through the journey of life, through the cycle of rebirth, that's why rebirth is a logical necessity. The moment you say there is a soul, individual soul, rebirth becomes a logical necessity even to explain the differences. And also because otherwise you are born once and you have one life, and there is so much differences, not only about rich and poor, that's not the important thing, but character, temperament. So you have one temperament, you have one life. Where you are born, you don't know. And that one life, with all these differences, you will make it or break it. But that's not how Indian thought looks at it. It says, everybody for everybody. May I paraphrase a Hindi film, because there was a Hindi film called Zindagi Na Milegi Dobara. You won't get this life again. So I said, nahi bhai, dobara, tibara, chobara. Life comes again and again. And with each life, we are pushed one step forward. So rebirth is an evolutionary mechanism. In one life, you have progressed to a point. All right. Not that it should lead to complacency, but you come back and you take up from where you had left. There are certain lessons you have not learned. You have to learn. There are certain kinds of things you have not gathered. Certain experiences you have not had. So one goes through. So there is a double life within us. One is the surface life and there is a deeper life. The deeper threads that connect our past with our future and connect us with others. which we don't know. So life becomes a very fascinating discovery. So this is one part. Second is with regard to world, because that source is equally in the world, therefore everything is sacred. To Sanatana Dharma, there is nothing like only cow is sacred, for God's sake. The tree is sacred. Animal life is sacred. Plant life is sacred. The sky is sacred, the sun is sacred, rain is sacred, even the snake is sacred. There is a puja for the serpent, Nag Panchami. The tulsi leaf is sacred, the bilva patra is sacred, the river is sacred, mountains are sacred. We have forgotten it, I agree. That's why Shobhita spoke of ruins. But the sense of the sacred which we have forgotten in today's times. So that's why in Sanatana Dharma you can pick up a stone and realize God. Because God dwells in that also. Of course, if you make a vigraha out of it, very nice. So that's why in Indian thought he had so many approaches. There are places you'll go where you'll see only there is a stone. And people are worshipping it. We grew up in our household where Shaligram was worshipped. And also if you go to Kedarnath, which is, you know, a famous teertha of Shiva. What is it? What is it there? Somebody would say with the material eyes there is a stone. Yes? But we are the ones who have the power to realize the highest in the lowest. Therefore, the concept of fallen forever doesn't exist in Hindu thought. We have stories of Kubja, Shabri, Jatayu. There is a line about Sri Rama, and I feel tempted to say it. It's in Hindi. Ganika, Ajamil, Vyad, Gid, Gajad, Khaltare Gana. Ganika is the lowly woman who earns a livelihood through, you know, going around in different places. Ajamil, the butcher. Vyad, the hunter. Gid, the vulture. All these Lord Rama takes along with him. Why? Because the divine dwells in them. Each one of them. And these such beautiful stories which we are not aware of. To what extent it has taken the idea of spiritual socialism. Let me put it like that. So just one small story, a quick short story. When one of the 5-year-old chit of a boy, what is his name? Jabali. Yeah, he goes to the guru and he says, I want to have the highest teaching. He asks his mother. Mom says, I don't know any teaching. I'm a maidservant. Why don't you ask? So she goes to Rishi Gautam and he says, I want to have Brahma Vidya, the highest kind of knowledge. Brahman is described as knowing which all else can be known. Look at the secret of science and everything. It was Brahma Vidya. Because it's the origin of everything, so all the shastras flow from there. If you know Brahman, you can apply it in medicine, engineering, every place. And this is not just a joke. And I can tell you the examples of it, but that would be a very long talk. So the Rishi asks him, okay, who's your dad? He says, I don't know. So he says, okay, can you find from your mom? So the mom, he says, Mom, who is my dad? He says, I don't know who is your dad. Now the boy is in for a shock. He said, what do you mean? He said, no, because when you were, I conceived you, I was working in many people's home as a maid. Look at the undertones. And so he goes and says that, well, that's what my mom has said. He says, I don't know who your dad is, but I am your mom for sure. Will you take me for Brahma Vidya? He says, it means your mother comes from a very high category of humanity. She has the courage to be truthful and honest. You are in. That's a beautiful story, how he learns and grows through nature. The guru sends him into nature and he says, go back into the forest. And there he goes into the forest and learns from everything. So even the idea of guru is something so interesting. There is in everyone a little seeker. And in everyone there is a guru, the Jagat Guru, the master, the divine is dwells within us. And when we are ready, he guides us. And he comes in the persona of an outer guide, if that be needed. Equally, ultimately, the journey is inside. So this is the idea of self and relation with the world. That world, everything is sacred. It doesn't mean that we are going to only do worship. No, worship is not the issue. Issue is, even when we eat something, which is bhogya vastu, as they call. You eat chicken, for example. I mean, I'm a votary for vegetarianism, but it's okay. Yeah. So what do we do? Everything before we eat, every water, sip of water before we drink, we consecrate it to the divine. Why? Because ultimately it is sacred, it belongs to the divine, and I have to take it because my body needs it, and therefore I consecrate it. So what happens as a result of it? It becomes prasad. So the idea of prasad is fantastic. I have not seen it anywhere. And we have grown up on the prasad culture. And you'll see even now we have, you know, of course there are langars and all these things. But look at what prasad means. Prasad means that whatever we eat, it is first offered to the deity. What does the deity do? Does he eat? That's not important. He looks at it. And Sri Aurobindo gives an example of this in one of his conversations. He says, what it really means, you take things to the king. So what does the king does? In olden times, he would remove the cover and he'll look at it, he'll touch it. And then he says, give it to my people. Now what has happened? It has become a gift from the king. So every morsel of food, every sip of water becomes a prasad. Why? Because now it has been offered to the Lord. It doesn't mean we have to carry it to the temple, because always, first thing first, the temple is within. There was a time when we didn't have temples. Of course, temples are beautiful manifestations, spaces, also pilgrim spots. All this is a different subject altogether. But the core is that man's body is the temple. And if we quietly offer it, that's how the Gita describes in one of the phrases, that Brahman is offering to Brahman and Brahman is eating. And that's how life should be lived. Then there's another very interesting concept, and it's of yajna. This is something, another wonderful thing in Sanatana Dharma. Yajna means, normally when we have something, we rush and have it, grab it. As nowadays this culture is, go grab it. It's such an ugly word actually, you know. Go grab it. Even the words and language indicates what degeneration of thought can take place. So you don't grab a thing. It doesn't belong to you. So what is yajna? You have something with you and you consecrate it. So now it's not yours. So what you should take? You should take what you really need. Now when, at least I was growing up, and I'm sure many of us during, these concepts were so much embedded that before I read about communistic ideology and all this, I said, but we have a wonderful solution. The solution is, when you eat, remember it's prasad. You don't have to eat like, you know, just for your palate. Enjoy by all means. It's not like you have to do some fasting, etc. That's a different story. Eat. But you'll automatically eat in moderation. Things like moderation, balance were emphasized. And much of the problem in this world is precisely that. A lot of disparity is simply because there is so much of greed. Now, if people were just to, not with the idea that I am feeding someone, but even in our own food, if we observe moderation, that's how the mother gave this thing in Pondicherry. What is the rule here? That eat as much as you can digest and take as much as you can eat. That's it. If the world were to follow this simple advice, it will be a much better place. All this disparity, you don't need big theories and ideologies struggling and clashing with each other. And it would apply to everything. Take what you really need. So this idea of yajna meant that, not that we'll just share with others. Before we share, of course we share with everybody. But before we share, we consecrate it to God. So that there is not this idea that I am the one who is sharing with you. You see, if we adopt that idea, then that's how mafia dons started their business. You read Godfather and you see what Duryodhan did with Karna. He gave him kingdom. No. That's not how it is done. You have consecrated it to divine. It's not you who is the giver. The divine who is the giver. The person is not obliged to you. He is obliged to the divine, the all merciful, the all benevolent, the all giver. So you have dharma, you have yoga, you have... Then what is the word used for this world? Each of these is a big subject. So yajna is by lighting the fire of aspiration within. That means everything must be sanctified, not only that, refined, purified. So yajna means literally putting in the flame, fire. So what happens? Supposing I have a tendency. Even let's say that two people are going to join physically. Now imagine you turn it into yajna. How do you turn it into yajna? There is the marriage ritual. Forget about the ritual part of it. You know what is the marriage ritual? Very interesting. Just taking one example. How togetherness can become a yajna. So in the marriage ritual, it's not some priest outside who is telling you, now you are married, put your name in the register, which is a legal contract. Now fire is the symbol of the divine. So who is the witness to your marriage? The divine is the witness. The promises you make and the promises you break is not a question of law. It's a question of the all-knowing divine witness. What will he do? Well, he has his ways. So that's a different story. Then the second aspect is that at the center, it's not Mr. Your Ego or Mrs. Your Ego. There's no place for ego at the center. You'll be burned. It's not even in-laws and parents. At the center is the fire, the urge for progress, the divinity. And often I say marriage problems, counseling, if you can keep the divine at the center, divinity at the center, life will be beautiful. If you don't do that, even if outwardly it is happy, it'll be very hollow inside. So you don't need a counselor. We never needed counselors. We had the Gita and all these things embedded here. Now we need counselors who don't know how to counsel themselves. Sorry to say, but as a psychiatrist, I can take a dig. Okay, so it's the fire of aspiration. Means fire means progress, agni, age. It means relentless urge for progress. That's how we had developed so many beautiful things. This urge for progress was the key of Hindu thought. And this progress, call it evolution, was reflected in so many ways, including the conception of the Dashavatar. So there is an inner evolution of the soul growing from the seed divine state to the full blossoming of the divinity through the trail of its Swadharma. But there was also the concept of outer evolution. Society changes. It evolves. Therefore, there is no dogma, no rigidity. Whatever was said 2000 years back, we must follow it. No. That's why avatars come and change the law. Take just two avatars. And we know the form also changes. So what is valid for Matsya avatar is different from what is valid for Narsingh avatar. Narsingh avatar is fierce. He is called as fierce avatar. Something of his fierceness goes into Parshuram. In between there is Vaman avatar, which is different. This is a wonderful story, but I've talked about it elsewhere. But Parshuram avatar. Now Parshuram avatar is an avatar who destroys all that is contrary to the way of life. You know, all that is according to him is not by the law, not by the, you know, it's not good. He does it in his sense of right. It's not like he's doing merciless, senseless killing. But he's killing all the arrogant Kshatriyas. He's killing those guys. But with Rama, it's not like that. Rama gives a chance. Rama humanizes. Rama brings the maryada. Therefore, he's maryada Purushottam. Parshuram is amaryadit, if you want to call it. But Rama brings maryada. He brings limits. You can't go. That's why we see everywhere he uses those limits, restraint. He sends emissaries. He tries to negotiate. And when all measures fail, he has to do what he has to do. And then you have Krishna. Krishna breaks the maryadas. But he breaks the maryada for something else. Why? Because now there are limits within human consciousness is put in. It's very good to tame the animal in us. But if to go from man to superman, to superhuman, so just as Ram is the ideal of what man could be, the ideal Aryan man. Arya is a very wonderful word and no time, but there is a talk on that. And Shubhendu said there is not a single word that has a nobler history than the word Arya. So we had an ideal type of man. Not just all human beings are equal. Okay, but that means I don't have to strive for anything. No, sir. There is an ideal humanity towards which you can strive. So we grow up with the ideal of Rama and Sita. I've just finished writing a piece, so I'm not going to what they represent. Why they are so wonderful and even today it's so difficult to surpass. Sita, highly empowered woman. She is the beacon of what feminism should be. This spiritual feminism at its ultimate. She needs nobody, not even Rama. And very few people know that while outer Ravan is destroyed by Rama, there is another dimension of Ravan which is known as Sahasramukh Ravan, which is a psychological condition. And that is destroyed by Mata Sita, even physically. That's how the story goes, and how she can be alone. She is independent woman. She brings up, not embittered, not seeking company. Neither of them get remarried. Amazing characters. I mean, I don't know. Mankind will find difficult even to cross that limit. But when you have gone into that limit, does everything according to the rule book or the Shastra, according to the Sattvic impulse, does evolution stop there? No. So Krishna comes to tell us, no, you can be utterly free and live by delight. But that freedom is not the freedom of the licentious man. Often people say, but where is individuality in Sanatana Dharma? There is. Very strong, fierce individuality. Look at Rama and Sita themselves. They don't listen to anybody once they've decided. Sita doesn't listen to anybody. And what is the argument? When parents and everybody says, she says, no, my dharma is that I walk with my partner. When Lakshman is asked, same answer. Bharat, can you imagine ever a life where Bharat, he says, I am not going to rule this kingdom because, oh mother, you have done a dharma. So our individuality in Sanatana Dharma is, an individual is not simply free to do whatever he feels like. But an individual should make his choices which are consistent with dharma, the law of truth, regardless even if the whole society is against him. Dharma of Meera is to walk out of the palace if she is, you know, abandoned from there. It's not her dharma to please the husband. She has to walk away because his request has grown so loud. Dharma of Arjun at the moment of war is to shoot and kill his near and dear ones, because that is a call of the moment, call of dharma to save mankind. It was needed because the larger context was that if that war was not fought, adharma will continue to reign this land. So dharma is such a wonderful thing, and it gives us the secret of individuality. An individual in Sanatana Dharma is somebody who stands by his dharma, lives by the dharma, even if he is opposed by everybody, including his parents, kith, kin, anybody whatsoever. And there are countless examples like that. So this is the concept of individuality. And then finally we come to Ishwara. We waited for it. What is the Hindu concept of Ishwara? One, we have already said. He is not just there on some ninth cloud or seventh heaven. All this. He is there, okay. But how does that, we are praying and whether he listens or not, all these issues come. Nor is he confined to the temple or the mosque or the church. Try keeping him there, he'll escape. So where is he? First is, he is everywhere, in everything, in everyone. I've already spoken about it. That's why when we meet and greet, we don't say hi, we say namaste. Whom are we saying namaste? Namas. Namas means to bow down. Whom are we bowing down? It may be as they say, a chandal, a man with very poor. But when you say namaste, what are you saying? You are basically saying, I bow to the divinity within you. You don't say in so many words. Or sometimes we greet by saying, Jai Ram Jeki. Somebody asked me a few days back, a friend from New Zealand, what is it that you always say, Jai Ma, before beginning? So I said, Jai Ma means victory to the Divine Mother. Jai Ram Jeki means victory to Rama. What are we really, what is this greeting? What does it mean? It means that we have met each other, let the truth win. So one of the guiding principles of Indian thought is Satyameva Jayate Nanritam Satyena Pantha Vitato Devyana. It is truth that wins, regardless of whatever, however long the struggle may be. 10 years, 20 years, lifetime, doesn't matter, truth will win, conquer. This embedded is there even in our Indian parliament, Satyameva Jayate. It is the mantra of India for the future. So Satyameva Jayate Nanritam. What is this country? She too, because divine presence is there. She is Vande Mataram. She is divine. She is mother, an aspect of the mother. So country is not just a piece of land over people fight. How absurd and silly it would be to fight for a piece of land. But if she is mother, why she is mother? Not just because she is nourishing us, but also because Indian thought saw behind the physical appearances to the deeper reality. So she is mother. Again, divine presence in everything. Is it only within individuals? No, it's also in cosmos. So this is the second layer of the divine. Universal. So whichever way you go, the universe is held within. Nowadays people talk about the space-time glasses. Space-time at one point doesn't exist mathematically. you start computing space, I think it is 10 to minus 23, it collapses. You, nothing, no prediction. You can't do any mathematical equations. Time beyond 10 to minus 37 or 36 seconds, I may be wrong, but about the figure. But there is a point where space-time collapses. So the question is, what is before space-time? That's why we are speaking of the big crunch before the big bang. But Indian thought has this. He says, physical space-time, beyond that there are several space-time continuums, several beings, several forces, energies, powers, climbing up to the one. That's why you'll see Indian temples, especially South Indian, mounting into a hierarchy and narrowing down to the Gopuram, which is the apex. That's how creation is. And that explains the number of gods. So in the journey of man, you have the gods, the devas and the devis, and you have the titans, the asuras. So what are they doing? The gods help us. So who are the gods? They are the cosmic powers. And that is logical. If there is one who is governing all these things, he would delegate from himself certain aspects that, look, you manage this function, you manage that function. To start with, you preserve this creation. You are responsible for destroying it. You are responsible for bringing it into existence. Very simple. Then for each aspect, there is a god of wealth. There is a god of this. There is a god for curing snake bite. There is a god for this. We have forgotten all these knowledge, but each god is a representative. He is acting on behalf of the one divine. So you can pick up any god, just like you can pick up any stone, and through it arrive at the divine. That's the beauty. You can worship Ganpati and worship as the supreme. You will realize supreme. You can take up Shiva, or you can take up, as I said, anything, Krishna, or none of these. You pick up a guru, a human guru. Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru Devo Maheshwara, Guru Sakshat Parabrahma, Tasmai Sri Guruve Namah. So in this universe, there are many layers of universes, many universes, each with its own powers, energies, influences, forces and beings. And they are known as gods and goddesses. It's a logical necessity, by the way, if you have to connect the one with creation. Because creation is many, many, many varied. Of course, you will ultimately resolve them to the one divine. So it's not true that we have only gods and goddesses. We have the concept of one divine, Ekameva Dvitiyam. But we also have Sarva Khalvidam Brahman, everything that is Brahman. So join this, you need the gods. Gods are the link between the one who is infinite and the many, the expression of infinity. Therefore, gods and goddesses are needed. Not only needed, I mean they exist. They exist is not just about outer. When you feel inspired, moved by a beautiful thought, a generous feeling, one of the gods is probably active. It's not like you have to be in a temple and worship them with a particular mantra. That's a different, that's why I said details we get lost. But equally there is the asura he opposes. So they are opponent powers. So while we are wanting to take up something beautifully, suddenly he says, why do all this? Why read the Gita? Why listen to all this? Why not enjoy life? Let's go to a pub. Let's get drunk. Who is this fellow? He is the asura. So what is, why asura is there also in creation? Because he is the one who ultimately ends up making us more and more sincere. You do it once, do it twice, after some time something in you will begin to feel. That's not how it should be. Maybe sometimes too late. So maybe in one life asura has being so-called winner, but ultimately he cannot be the ultimate winner. So that's why rebirth and relive. So there is the one deva, there are many gods and goddesses, there are the titans, and there is a constant war going on between the two. And this last little bit I'll leave. What is the war? The war is taking place between the gods and the titans. Why? For the nectar of immortality. That's the goal. What does immortality mean? Survival of this personality? No. Immortality means discovering the indestructible element, the source, the origin. It's another way to put it. It's immortal. It cannot be destroyed. It's deathless. There are several other layers of meaning of immortality, but I am not touching that. But the minimum is to touch, discover that which is not destructible, which is not cabined within any limits, because only the limitless cannot be destroyed, which is open to the infinite. Infinite cannot be destroyed, which is eternal. Internal cannot be destroyed, because it's not subject to time. So But before that nectar of immortality, whether we are ready for it or not, there is the story where the kalkud, the poison, comes out. So every time we go in our life, before the day psychiatrists existed in this world, in India, Gita and these stories existed. And they were so beautiful. I remember a 5-year-old child. In front of me, this incident has happened, whose grandmother was all talking about saris and the price and all this. This child was probably getting bored because it was very distracting for him in whatever he was doing. And I had told this child all the stories of Puranas and all this. I love these stories. So suddenly he turns and says, "Nani, you want Amrit or Mohini?" Well, she was shocked. So I had to explain what he means. But Nani didn't know what is Amrit and Mohini. So I said, no, this is in the story from Bhagavat and Vishnu Puran, that the last test that you are given, even after the poison is over, is that, well, you can become the king of all the worlds, all that you desire. Do you want that? Mohini, Vishwamohini. And that too is God. God has become Vishwamohini. He has become the tempter. Look at the beauty of the story. Or you want immortality. So if you want immortality, you have to pass through that. The last test is the test of success. It's not the test of failure. And that's when we have to understand, keep our head on the shoulders. Why? Who failed in that test? Ravan failed in that test. Precisely. Great Pandit, great, Veena Vadak, great erudite scholar, supposed to be a great Bhakta. But when success came his way, he lost it. So these are such beautiful stories. So much more, but obviously, paucity of time. I'll just end with one passage from Sri Aurobindo and why all this is so important. So K.M. Munshi, many of us may know, he had once come to Sri Aurobindo and says, "I would like to have your guidance as regards to the future of Sanatana Dharma." He is only one of those whom Sri Aurobindo gave an interview even as late as 49, when he was not meeting people, because he was his student. And Sri Aurobindo was always for his students. So he replies through someone. So it is like Sri Aurobindo says. Sri Aurobindo asked Purani ji to reply. "My dear Kanu Bhai, you are feeling that there should be reintegration of Indian culture under modern conditions is quite right. It is the work that has to be done. And as far as Sri Aurobindo can see at present, Indian spiritual culture has a great and bright future before it. It is the future power that might dominate the world. It is the future power it required for the world. So your efforts in carrying out that work are quite in the right direction. And in carrying out that work, you would have his full support and blessings." And then Sri Aurobindo describes what Sanatana Dharma is when Sri Krishna gives him the Gita. So he says, "I was not only to understand intellectually, but to realize what Sri Krishna demanded of Arjun and what he demands of those who aspire to do his work. To be free from repulsion and desire, to do work for him without the demand for fruit." So people wonder, where will the impulsion come? That's what people miss, the joy of work for the joy of work. The spirit of service we have forgotten. Everything is salary, how much what we are going to get. Sometimes, kabhi seva bhav se bhi karo. Do it for the joy of service and see what comes. All that we were thinking of buying, you will get instantly. That's what is instant karma in my view. To do work for him. Just do 1 hour in a day. That I'll not do this thing for myself or my gain. But do it as a service. Service to God. Maybe I'll brush my own shoes. But I'll do it as a service to God. I'll cook as service to God. Just 1 hour a day. I can tell you it has a potential to change the life. It's not meditation. Meditation may be difficult. But just doing seva one day, without expectation of fruits, appreciation from others or nothing. So this culture of, paying people for doing work to teach them dignity of labor is so silly. By the way, you're bringing them few steps down. It's work for the joy of work. Why not? This is the teaching of Indian culture. to do work for him without the demand for fruit, to renounce self-will and become a passive and faithful instrument in his hands, to have an equal heart for high and low, friend and opponent, success and failure, yet not to do his work negligently. I realized what the Hindu religion meant. So what is this Sanatana Dharma? He says it is life itself. And this was cherished in the seclusion of this peninsula from of old, the India, Bharatvarsh. It is to give this religion that India is rising. She does not rise as other countries do for self, or when she is strong to trample on the weak. We have examples all over the world. What countries are rising and what they are doing, I don't need to talk about it. It is too obvious. And what has India done always? It has given not just Kohinoor. Kohinoor was stolen, but it gave the Gita. It gave the Buddha. It is giving Sri Aurobindo's teachings. That's how India is. So he says, she is rising to shed the eternal light and trusted to her over the world. India has always existed for humanity and not for herself. And it is for humanity and not for herself that she must be great. Look at how beautiful it is. We talk about humanitarianism. Here is the key to humanitarianism. What is the greatest service to man? Give him a pair of dress or shoes and feed him and then convert him? The greatest service to awaken him to his own deeper reality. That's what made a Ratnakar the dacoit into Valmiki, the great poet whom we revere till today. That is what is India's gift to the world. And then he says, there is a mighty law of life, a great principle of human evolution, a body of spiritual knowledge and experience of which India has always been destined to be guardian, exemplar and missionary. So this third layer also of the divine existence, Ishwara, he is the Lord, everything is for him. It's not for us, it's for him. But he is the one who through yajna gives to all. And he gives to each one whatever is needed and whatever will help us in our growth. Not needed only in terms of, you know, how much cash he is delivering. He is delivering much important wealth. So this is the Sanatana Dharma, the eternal religion. Under the stress of alien impact, she has largely lost hold, not of the structure of that Dharma, but of its living reality. For the religion of India is nothing if it is not lived. So it's not about going to temples, doing rituals, understanding its spirit and living it in everyday life. It has to be applied not only to life, but to the whole of life. Its spirit has to enter into and mold our society, our politics, our literature, our science, our individual character, affections and aspirations. Why love someone? Not because what advantage you will get out of that person. To love because in that person too divine dwells. It's to love your own self in that person. To give without calculation and bargain. Because you don't give something from your right hand to the left hand. Say, I am giving to you. So absurd. This is the highest ideal of love that Hindu thought has given to the world. To love the other as your own self. Because Aham Brahmasmi and Tattvamasi. Thou art also divine. Highest way to love. So, it is the Sanatana Dharma that shall be great when it is said that India shall expand and extend herself. It is the Sanatana Dharma that shall expand and extend itself all over the world. So, and then something he predicts for the future. The world moves through an indispensable interregnum of free thought and materialism. 100 years back he is writing, 120 years back. To a new synthesis of religious thought and experience. A new religious world life free from intolerance, yet full of faith and fervor, accepting all forms because it has an unshakable faith in the One. And yet, it is none of these forms. Is that to which the world spirit moves? In our own, which is the most skeptical and the most believing of all. The most skeptical because it has questioned and experimented the most. Where will you find a religion where one of the principal book, the Gita, is question answers? Arjun asks him and Krishna answers. One religious book, scripture. Also some of the Upanishads are like that, where there is question answers. So it has allowed us to question, but question is seeking spirit. You don't have to accept anything by belief. Even Arjun, who is a friend of Krishna, doesn't accept it by belief. He asks, clarify the mind. Where will we find this kind of liberality? It has questioned and experimented the most believing, because it has the deepest experience. Vedanta, Tantra, various forms of yoga, so many 64 kinds of vidyas, shastras. I mean, it's unimaginable, mind-boggling if you just go. And the most varied and positive spiritual knowledge. That wider Hinduism, which is not a dogma or combination of dogmas, but a law of life. That Hinduism has nothing to do with that. If you have period, don't go to temple, for God's sake. It's a rule of hygiene, that's all. It was needed at one point of time. Don't cabin Hinduism into the cooking pot. Swami Vivekananda would roar this. That don't turn Hinduism into the cooking utensil. Okay, be clean, fine. But Hinduism is to turn your own being, body, a vessel of God, in which God will cook his best dishes, and using our speech and hands, distribute it to the world. This is Hinduism, which rejects nothing, but insists on testing and experiencing everything. And when tested and experienced, turning it to the soul's uses. In this Hinduism, we shall find the basis of the future world religion. So, final word, what are we to do? Shubhendu says, we say to the individual, and especially to the young who are now arising to do India's work, and one is seeing this everywhere, and I'm sure this meeting is one of the signs of that. It's not randomly people join. People join because they are missioned by the same divine spark. Something which has to be done. They are rising to do India's work, the world's work, God's work. You cannot cherish these ideals, still less can you fulfill them. If you subject your minds to European ideas or look at life from the material standpoint, they atmbodh, body is all. There is no soul within. Maybe there is a ghost. Maybe there is a energy. No, soul is something different. It's not an energy or a ghost for God's sake. For ghost's sake, it's an indestructible portion of the divine. Materially, you are nothing. Spiritually, you are everything. It is only the Indian who can believe everything, dare everything, sacrifice everything, because he doesn't have any fear, because he is Brahman. Brahman is not afraid of anything. First, therefore, become Indians. What it means to become Indian, it's nothing to do with passport. You may have the blue passport or the black passport, it doesn't matter. So what it means to become Indian? Recover the patrimony of your forefathers. They didn't have a passport. Recover the Aryan thought, the Aryan discipline, the Aryan character, the Aryan life. Recover the Vedanta, the Gita, the Yoga. Recover them not only in intellect, all these debate discussions on, no, not only in intellect or sentiment, but in your lives. Live them and you will be great and strong, mighty, invincible and fearless. Neither life nor death will have any terrors for you. Difficulty and impossibility will vanish from your vocabularies. That's why often people say demography and all that. Don't worry. One true Indian is worth a million people in ignorance. Because that's how we see. We have grown up with Bhishma and Arjun and Krishna. It's not numbers that matter. It's that one or 100. You see that movie was there, no? Spartans. I've forgotten the name of the movie where these 300 Spartans take on the whole. So you have one Arjun taking on the whole army. You can't imagine that. So he says you will be fearless. Impossibility will vanish. For it is in the spirit that strength is eternal. And you must win back the kingdom of yourself, Swaraj. The inner Swaraj, before you can win back your outer empire. There the mother dwells and she waits for worship that she may give strength. Again, so beautiful toward the end. Indian thought. Sanatan Dharma is the one and only Dharma, religion, call it whatever, which worships the feminine as the eternal feminine. Nowhere else she is given that place. Not just human mother. All forms of feminine, they are devis. Now we have forgotten all this because we have come under alien influences, frankly. But when a woman entered the house, she was Lakshmi who had to enter. And if you misbehaved with her, she could become Durga and Kali. So better behave. That's how it was. All the Devi, see all the Devi festivals. And she is the mother of God. Where can we find this this service to the feminism? Recently I was sharing, just one little incident, that somebody talking about woke and said, you know, women right, equality. I said, by the way, you have no clue about India and the Indian context. All this may apply elsewhere. But in India, we have worshipped women, still worship her as the Devi. And you want to teach us that, you know, you have equal right. She has more right. She is, of course, we have forgotten it. But that's the way to recover it. Spiritual feminism. And not this idea that she can drink, smoke and be like anybody, cool, so-called. That's falling into a hole along with the man. So there the mother dwells. Believe in her. Serve her. Lose your wills in hers. Your egoism in the greater ego of the country. Your separate selfishness in the service of humanity. Recover the souls of all strength in yourself. And all else will be added to you. Social soundness. Intellectual preeminence. Political freedom. The mastery of human thought. The hegemony of the world. Ya Devi Sarva Bhuteshu. Shakti Rupen Sangstita. Namastasyai. 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 Namo Namah. Jai Maa.